at Central Time, I'm Rob Ferris. You're with us here on the Ideas Network. Coming up, we'll learn more about the unique flavors and foods of Korea from Mun Chi, host of a popular Korean cooking YouTube channel. First, our next guest spent years documenting corruption in Afghanistan and tracking the networks that tied government officials, business people, criminals, and even Taliban insurgents together. And she found that corruption in that country and in countries around the world has a toxic impact on the public well-being and on governance. If you're hoping that the United States is an exception to that rule, she's got bad news for you. In a recent book, Sarah Chase details networks that connect wealthy, powerful, and influential people and institutions in the United States. She says the courts have opened the door wider and wider to more types of corruption. And the only cure is you and people like you. Sarah Chase is an author, a former NPR reporter, and former special advisor to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff. Her latest book out now is On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Sarah, thanks for joining us.
Thank you, Rob.
You have looked at corruption in many countries around the world. It may look different from one place to another. Do you have kind of a working definition for corruption that kind of applies everywhere?
You know, I think regular people kind of get it. It's really the misuse of positions of power for personal gain rather than the public interest. And positions of power can be in business as well as government. As you suggested in your intro, legal definitions are no longer helping us much because there has been a campaign over the last, 20, 30 years in the United States to narrow the legal definition of corruption. I want to say turn it more and more technical. So basically, you have to be pretty bad at being corrupt in order to actually get prosecuted. And I do think regular American citizens understand corruption differently.
Yeah, talk about a Supreme Court case that you opened the book with as kind of a turning point where it really defines the definition of bribery and corruption to, as you're saying, kind of this bare minimum, somebody taking a literal bag with a dollar sign on it.
That's right. It was the Supreme Court overturned the conviction for corruption of a former Virginia governor. Now, this happened in late June. The decision was handed down late June 2016, right? And what was amazing, two things were amazing to me. One was 8-0. I mean, not a single justice could understand why Bob McDonald, taking a bunch of cash and rides in Ferraris and various other goodies from some quack, pharma manufacturer, in return for pressuring members of the Virginia state executive branch to, including the education department, to conduct clinical trials, not a single justice understood that obvious quid pro quo as corruption, not a single one. And the second thing that really distressed me was the language that the opinion uses to sort of poo-poo corruption. Well, it's not our place to get into the tawdry details of Rolexes and Ferraris. Our place, said the opinion, is to prevent the fight against corruption from running rampant. So the opinion makes it out like America has more to worry about the fight against corruption than corruption itself. Well, I had just spent a decade showing how corruption leads to violent extremism, it leads to revolution, it leads to mass migration, it leads to environmental devastation. I mean, just about every major crisis in the world today, you scratch the surface and you find corruption underneath it. And so what I was seeing was the Supreme Court and a lot of the sort of conventional elites, frankly, across the political divide, kind of downplaying and dismissing corruption as a serious problem. This is June 2016. It wasn't 2 or 3 weeks later before you've got two maverick presidential candidates upending the U.S. political scene with contrasting, chants against corruption. I'm not trying to imply that those two candidates were or are equivalent, But I am saying that the focus on corruption galvanized a gigantic proportion of the American electorate. And I still don't really think that the mainstream of American political elite establishment gets it.
Before we dig more into corruption in the United States and what it looks like, I want to talk about solutions and one possible downfall of talking about it. Sarah, I think sometimes people say, yeah, there's corruption. All the politicians are the same. It's just the way it is. There's nothing I can do about it. That is not, I think, the message you're hoping to send in your book.
That is not. The message that I'm sending is that corruption, as we're experiencing it today, not just in the United States, but elsewhere around the world, is not just the venal behavior of individuals, even a lot of them, even everyone. It's actually it's a kind of operating system. It is a means by which a sophisticated network of dominators is victimizing the rest of us, frankly. And what's really interesting is that network crisscrosses all of the sectors that we hold separate in our minds, right? I mean, it's both the private sector and the public sector. It's, you know, so it's business and politicians, and people are switching back and forth between business and politics all the time. It's the justice sector. It's a lot of the, there are often foundations and nonprofits associated, and often out and out criminals, you know? And so, but these are purposeful networks. And it's not the case that either in American or world history, that these networks have been in as dominant a position as they are today. And that's one of the things I really look at in On Corruption is that it ebbs and flows. And the last time we really experienced a situation like this was the late 19th and early 20th centuries. And it was very similar. And we did not experience it as much. I'm not saying it was perfect, but it really wasn't like this in the period between about 1940 and about 1980. And I look at why. And so I do not think that we can afford to say this is business as usual. Because you know what happened when it was business as usual in the Gilded Age? It drove us into World War I, World War II, Great Depression, two world wars, two genocides, nuclear bomb, pandemic that makes COVID look like peanuts, and a world economic meltdown. It is an incredibly dangerous phenomenon if left unchecked.
Talking to Sarah Chase about her book On Corruption in America and What is at Stake. Sarah, at certain places and certain times, we might experience corruption very personally. I have to bribe an official to keep my business license, say, or to make sure I get police protection or my water turned on or whatever. I don't think it's as in your face for average Americans now. How would you tell kind of an ordinary person that the corruption and the form we have of it hurts them?
I actually think most ordinary Americans do experience it. I mean, I've gone around asking folks, and basically what they say is rich people own the political system. But what that means is, you know, you might get slapped with an EPA, you know, ticket for a leaky outboard motor when the giant factory that's belching toxic chemicals into your river is left alone. I mean, that's personal, right? And take 2008. That was not just an act of, you know, the great God economy. That was due to systemic fraud within a network system of financial service, you know, businesses who had worked together with public officials to reduce a whole raft of protections for ordinary citizens that are sometimes denigrated as regulations. But these were rules that prevented real estate agents and appraisers and insurance agencies and mortgage lenders from abusing the public. And those were dismantled. And the result was as many deaths as were caused by 9/11 to suicide, how many families wrecked, how many careers wrecked, how many people, you know, ejected from their homes, that was corruption.
We're talking with author Sarah Chase right now about her recent book On Corruption in America. And we want to hear it from you. Do you feel like our politics, our economy, or other parts of the American system are corrupt? What worries you the most? Have you noticed certain types of corruption become more common and accepted in your lifetime? What do you think should be done to make things operate more fairly? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know what you think. We'll continue the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're picking up our talk with Sarah Chase, author of the new book On Corruption in America. And we want to hear from you. Do you feel like America's government or economy are corrupt? Where do you see the biggest signs of that? Does unfairness and corruption make you feel powerless, or does it fire you up? What do you think needs to happen legally, culturally, to track down on corruption? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. Sarah, we do see public figures sometimes call out corruption from the other side. Republicans point out corruption for Democrats, Democrats for Republicans. You say that's not enough. We need consistent standards that we hold everybody to. What could that look like?
Rob, I'm so glad you asked that, because one of the things I noticed looking at anti-corruption efforts in other countries, ordinary citizens, is that, you know, the corrupt networks don't just take it laying down, right? They fight back. And the most powerful tool that I saw them employing both abroad and at home is the identity divides. In our country at the moment, I mean, race is a big identity divide, but politics is a big one too. And so what ends up happening is anti-corruption gets turned into a partisan issue, and somehow everyone has a really good eye for the corruption on the other side of the political divide, but they somehow get blinded when it's their own people. And I have to say, I've gotten some pushback from people on the left who assume that that's where I am when I, you know, raise issues with Democratic Party figures. They don't have any issue with my raising issue, you know, my raising corruption with respect to Trump or figures from the Reagan administration, and vice versa. And so long, meanwhile, these networks turn out to be pretty well welded across the political divide. That's what's really astonishing. Take a look at who Madeleine Albright is in business with. Take a look at who Scaramucci invited to some big gala he held last year, a big investment gala. I mean, it's really, you know, and so we are fighting against each other. And so long as the networks have us pitted against each other across this political divide, we're going to keep losing. So, you know, some of the suggestions I have to do with that, with, for example, a nonpartisan candidate's pledge on some basic ethical issues, or, you know, no matter who's in charge of your state, take a look at the state bribery and gift laws, conflict of interest laws. Are they strong enough? What kind of enforcement is being devoted to them? And that's another kind of interesting thing. There's a lot of talk about defunding or refunding or changing the funding of the police. I would say, hey, the police isn't just street crime. And not all nonviolent offenses are not dangerous. Nonviolent drug offenses might be considered to be not very dangerous to society, but nonviolent corporate crime and corruption is unbelievably dangerous. And so let's be careful to distinguish among types of nonviolent crime, and let's refund the public integrity police.
Let's go to our callers now at 800-642-1234. Tree with us in Madison now. Tree, hi.
Hi.
What did you want to bring up?
I have a question. Why is it that Donald Trump gets to scale back the EPA when all the things that from the EPA were in place, and why is he getting away with it?
Tree, thanks for the call. Sarah, can you talk a little bit about the Trump administration and environmental protections?
Yeah, and environmental is one of a number of these. Thank you, Tree. So what these networks do, and I've seen it everywhere around the world, and environment ministries, which is what they often are in other countries, are systematically disabled. Any semi-independent body of government whose role is to protect the people or the land or, you know, the resources that all people need, those get disabled. And so this is absolutely in line with what I've seen elsewhere around the world. He gets away with it because it's an executive branch agency. Now, I'd like to just venture from this question into part of the book that often doesn't get as much attention, but it's really central to the thinking. It's the first chapter of this book on corruption in America is actually plunges us into Greek mythology of all things. And it's about Midas, you know, the guy who everything he touched turned to gold. Now, the word or the expression the Midas touch in American English is often seen as a good thing. Well, we've missed the myth completely, because back to the EPA, what Midas does, I mean, he asks for the gift that everything he could touch would turn to gold. Well, think of that in today's world. People afflicted with the Midas disease are touching our waters and our mountains and our forests, and they're turning them into gold, right? They're turning them into zeros in their bank accounts. And the intrinsic, inestimable, if you will, worth of those, I don't want to call them resources, of those treasures, of those miracles, are being reduced to zero. That's the Midas disease. And when we live in a world where the Midas disease is exalted, it is mortal danger.
Thanks a lot for that call. We're talking to Sarah Chase about her new book on corruption in America and what is at stake. Back to your calls now. Hans is with us now in Merrill. Hans, hello.
Hi there. I just sort of showed up to the program, so if you guys covered this, I apologize. But it seems to me that at least here in the state of Wisconsin, and certainly in a lot of places around the country, just a ferocious form of corruption is how gerrymandered our legislative and congressional districts are. In Wisconsin, they were written behind, you know, drawn behind closed doors with sophisticated computer technology and lawyers, and there was nothing transparent about it. And whether it's done by Republicans or Democrats, it certainly has a huge impact on how well we're represented. And it also then goes hand in hand perfectly with the, you know, the corrupting influence of money in our political system.
Hans, thanks a lot for the call. And I want to throw this to Sarah, because Sarah, you cover that 2010 redistricting effort. Can you talk about that?
Yes. And in fact, the title of the book that really lays it all out, I can't say on radio, it's rat, and then there's a curse
Bleeping.
Word after that. And it is a great book that shows exactly this. And I couldn't agree more with Hans. I mean, the point of the corrupt networks, or again, to use a Greek mythological analogy that I use, the Hydra, the many-headed Hydra, capturing the powers of government and rigging the system. Well, one of the important powers of government, obviously, is the power to write the rules. And in the United States of America and in our states, it's the legislatures that fundamentally do most of that. And so there is no better example of rigging the system than gerrymandering. And that is an issue that I agree, no matter the political persuasion, has got to be eradicated from the American political system. It should not be legislators who choose their voters. It's supposed to be the voters who choose the legislators.
Hans, thanks a lot for that call. Time for one more caller. Randy is with us now in Madison. Randy, hello.
Hey, good afternoon. Ms. Chase, I was wondering that there has been many examples of very blatant corruption. And for instance, the use of Mar-a-Lago for the G7 summit, which was canceled because of public pressure. And I wonder if you have any insight into what it is that the public can do to actually reverse some of that corruption.
Thanks for that call, Sarah. What a great question for our last couple of minutes.
Perfect. And in fact, On Corruption in America's epilogue is a large kind of compendium of various things we can do, both in the public sphere and the private sphere. And I think we need to do both. The first major point is there isn't a single magic bullet. And again, looking at anti-corruption insurrections, if you will, overseas, what I've noticed is a tendency, tends to be, let's knock off the guy at the top or the gal at the top. And that's kind of like chopping off one head of the Hydra. Well, that's another very insightful myth that tells us, number one, that's not good enough because the Hydra grows some more heads. Number two, even Hercules isn't enough. Even the greatest hero alone isn't enough. He needed his charioteer who cauterized the stumps. That is to say, it's going to take all of us doing all of the different things that we're good at doing. And frankly, I actually think it's going to take some defections from the moneyed classes, if you will. I mean, take a look at FDR. Look at where he came from. And without his leadership, I'm not sure we could have gotten out of the first Gilded Age. And so I think that we need to push for real ethical standards. They need to change from being norms to being, enforceable law. We need more money and more stature for public integrity beats in public prosecutors' offices. We need, obviously, gerrymandering, public financing of campaigns needs to be limited, but also in our everyday lives. Look at who you're buying from. Look at where you bank your money. Choose with your own daily choices to honor people who have not made making billions of dollars their objective.
Sarah, thanks a lot for joining us today.
Rob, thank you so much for having me. Pleasure to be back at WPR.
Sarah Chase joined us to talk about her latest book on corruption in America. Coming up after the news, if you've never tried to cook Korean food at home, our next guest really wants to help you try it. We'll learn more about the unique flavors and foods of Korea from Manchi, host of a popular Korean cooking YouTube channel. I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. Listening to Central Time, I'm Rob Ferret. Have you checked out WPR.org lately? You can listen to past shows, read both fun and informative digital articles, and get the latest from the WPR News Department. Check it out at WPR.org. Now, our next guest has been called the Korean Julia Child by the New York Times, and her followers call her their Korean mom. Her internet and cooking world fame comes largely in part from her YouTube channel with over 4 million subscribers, where she posts videos explaining step-by-step how to make all different kinds of Korean foods, including these cinnamon cookies filled with white bean paste. Mangchi was born and raised in South Korea, where she learned the fundamentals of home cooking with her family. Her website is mangchi.com. That's M-A-A-N-G-C-H-I.com. Her new cookbook is called Mangchi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, from everyday meals to celebration cuisine. Mangchi, thanks for joining us.
Thank you for inviting me.
How did you get started making these YouTube cooking videos, Mangchi?
I was sharing my recipes, and I thought that it would be fun if anybody who is interested in my recipes, and then I want to share. So because entire my life so far, just food is always important in my life. And everybody tastes my food, and it's delicious, they said. So just on YouTube, started, in the early time, around 13 years ago, I started. And once I posted my video, and everybody loved that. And I was so happy, excited, and then I just kept going on so far.
And I got to say, I think part of why people like it, Mangchi, is you make it look really fun. Cooking is, you really get a lot of joy and fun out of cooking, don't you?
Yeah, you like cooking?
I do. I like to cook, but I don't think I have as much as fun as you do.
Cooking is fun. And while you are cooking, this is making for yourself and for your family, your loved ones. why you are not excited, you know? So whenever I cook, and every three meals, I'm so excited about my next meal. So everything should be delicious and clean and healthy. Sometimes not healthy, but once in a while, it's okay.
And a lot of your recipes, Mongchi, are also easy. You take it step by step, and you try to keep it simple. Some are more complicated, but you really focus on things we can do at home, right?
Yeah. I just work hard. How can I make this simple? And people who follow my recipe, they don't know anything about Korean food. And how can they follow my direction, you know, so step by step, so easily? And then actually, I just plan a lot. And then just that's it. And also, I always, I don't like a complicated process, whatever I do. But cooking, when I do my cooking, even just before I started YouTube, I always want to make a simple and delicious food without losing any authenticity.
Korean food has gotten more popular in the United States in the last few years. What is it that makes Korean food special?
Yeah, what do you think?
I don't know. I mean, I know a little bit about Korean food, but I got to say a lot of it is new to me, going through your cookbook, for example.
Yeah. Or, you know, I'm surrounded by people who love Korean food already. So it sounds like Korean food is a trend. But recently I traveled to Mexico and I met some people from, they are from Texas. And they don't know anything about even kimchi. So, you know, see, still, you know, not many people know about Korean food. But as you said, you know, in a few years, it is kind of a trend, you know, Korean, including Korean pop, you know, also, you know, Korean drama, and it's a Korean food too. So New York Times always talk about Korean restaurant, you know, so that means that, you know, Korean food gets some interest. Yeah. And when I studied, actually, you know, not many people knew about even kimchi. But as we talk about this, many people are interested in Korean drama. In the drama, they see that a lot of, you know, their favorite actor, actress, they eating some kind of, you know, spicy food, and then they are checking out, okay, what is it about? And then they found my recipe, and they follow my, you know, directions. And also, you know, some kind of, you know, the people, I think definitely it's from online. Online is make it possible. So especially this YouTube is also online, and also through online, like, you know, taco truck, you know, California, you know, the Roiche, and the taco truck, you know, Korean style and Mexican kind of a cuisine, you know, mixed. So it's all this is through the online, I think it's getting popular.
Mongchi is with us for Food Friday. You can watch her online. Her website is mongchi.com. That's MANGCHI.com. She's got a very popular YouTube channel on Korean cooking. We're talking about her new book. It's Mongchi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. Mongchi, you just mentioned kimchi. That's something I like a lot these days. I grew up with some Polish cooking, so we had sauerkraut. So it's a similar idea, that fermented cabbage. Tell us about kimchi and what makes that special.
So actually, you know, one of my readers, he also makes a sauerkraut. And then he says that, okay, kimchi is so similar to a sauerkraut. And then makes kimchi on a regular basis with their friends at home. And kimchi is, you know, fermented food, but actually when you eat, it doesn't have to be fermented. I love freshly made kimchi, and it's a kind of a salad, Korean salad, but you can keep in the refrigerator for a long time. So sometimes aged kimchi, so you can age years. And, you know, and when you add a lot of salt, and then it's going to be the, you know, fermentation process is going to slow down. So that kimchi has all nutrients inside, and vegetable, plus I use, you know, fish sauce, and also fermented fish, and also sometimes I add some shrimp there, and kind of, you know, we prepare the kimchi, it's just this is so staple that we always, Korean, every family has their different, little bit different recipes, and they focus on how to make delicious, you know, kimchi. So that's that's why kimchi is very, very important.
You shared some recipes with us. There's one with kimchi in it. People can find that at WPR.org/Food Friday. You have a kimchi stew. What else goes into a kimchi stew along with the kimchi?
What else? Kimchi, kimchi, you know, first to make a kimchi stew, delicious one, and then you need to ferment. Fermented kimchi means that it tastes sour. So you chop it up, kimchi, and then put it in, on the pot or any pan. And then I needed some protein. So I use sometimes in a can of tuna or sometimes in a pork belly. So pork belly with a little fat, and then also onion and a little bit Korean hot pepper paste and mix together, and I add some stock. It should be delicious. And then you just boil this, and then really, like, it tastes like a sweet and a little bit sour. And also, we call this kimchi also, it's a little crispy, even though it's cooked. So I have met many people. Some people don't like a kimchi smell, but I never met anybody who doesn't like a kimchi stew, because when it's cooked, the texture is changing, and also really, really kind of a complexity of the, you know, the taste, the flavor is enjoying. Everybody enjoy this kimchi jjigae, kimchi stew.
We're talking with Meng Chi. She teaches Korean cooking to her millions of YouTube followers and posts recipes at mengchi.com. That's MAANGCHI.com. Her recent cookbook is called Meng Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. And we want to hear from you. Have you tried some Korean cooking? Did you grow up with it? What kind of things have you made? How did it turn out? Are you able to find Korean ingredients where you live? Tweet us at Central Time WPR and let us know. We'll pick up the Food Friday conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret. We continue our Food Friday conversation with Meng Chi. She's the internet's Korean mom with her easy-to-follow YouTube cooking videos. She's talking with us about her cookbook, Meng Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. And we want to hear from you. Do you have experience cooking, maybe eating Korean foods? What do you like best? What do you like least? Have you made your own kimchi? How'd it go? Tweet us at Central Time WPR. I want to talk about not a recipe, but I love this concept, Meng Chi, the Korean lunchboxes. Could you tell us about the concept and how these come together?
Yes. Korean lunchbox is called the doshirak. So doshirak, I just made my doshirak for my family for a long time. So it's like, you know, and the doshirak is that all the housewives get together. My friends, you know, whenever we meet, we talk about what are you going to make these days, doshirak side dish, doshirak banchan. So banchan, side dishes are very important because my loved ones will eat this. So doshirak is, I made this one chapter, total whole chapter is for my doshirak chapter. When my editor asked me, to make a new book, I said that I can make a, you know, one book, total whole one book for doshirak, Korean lunchbox, and then, but she wanted to make them more. So this is my, you know, second book, and then this, it is one chapter is my totally like a doshirak. So doshirak is, you know, Korean meal is rice and side dishes. Rice is, we use short grain rice, and this rice is kind of a little stickier than long grain rice, and also blend. So we need some kind of salty stuff. So that's kind of a mom or like anybody who makes lunchbox, Korean doshirak, and then we need to think about a well-balanced diet. Mm-hmm. A carb is rice, and sometimes I make that, you know, the multigrain rice. Multigrain rice recipe is also in my book. And then, you know, what kind of, you know, protein I can use. Okay, I'm going to use in a fish fillet, or sometimes, you know, some tuna pancake, or sometimes, you know, beef, salty beef. And I need also vegetables, you know, some kind of for the vitamins. And then I just kind of choose that some sliced cucumber and sauté. So all everything is easy. And also some side dishes are, this side dish we call this mit banchan. If you make this and then keep in the containers, you can keep in the refrigerator 1 week or even until 1 month. So this kind of mit banchan is anytime you can just take it out from the refrigerator, just you can eat with rice. It can be one meal. But Korean mom cannot give the wrap this rice, you know, rice and mit banchan only. So I have to make a freshly cooked something. So that's kind of I usually make a kind of protein. Sometimes roll the egg in a kind of omelet style, and sometimes, you know, tuna pancake. Mm. And then I just make the mix and match, and also colorful. Color should be, everything should look really nice and appetizing, you know. So, and also kimchi. Kimchi is a kind of pungent smell, so I always find the small container and then put it in the kimchi, right? And then eating between the, you know, some kind of a dried food and rice, and then you feel like a kimchi, so eating in the middle, like between the rice and other side dishes. So I was always focusing on my what to wrap for my children, you know. That's kind of my whole interest in life when they grow up. Yeah.
Let's bring on a caller. Ellen is with us in Delavan. Ellen, hi.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to call in and tell Mang Chi that I'm so grateful for her books. I have both books. My son spent 3 years in Korea in the service, and he came home in love with the Korean food. And so I tried to learn to cook it. And thanks to your books, he says my food is better now, my Korean food. So.
And Ellen, do you watch? Have you worked from her videos too?
Oh, yes, yes. You're my favorite, one of my favorite YouTubers. I sit and watch you and, what do you call that, binge watch Mang Chi.
Yeah.
Ellen,
you
thanks
are one
so much.
Of them.
Yeah, you've got a lot of fans, Mang Chi. Do you run into people as you're out and about who recognize you from the YouTube videos?
All the time. Whenever I go, you know, even I'm living in Manhattan in the center, so whenever I walk around, then the people just say, oh, Mang Chi. Even the not you know, only in Manhattan. Just I go to even last time Nice in France, and then there was a dark night. And then I just walk, and then somebody coming out of the hair salon, and then, oh, Mang Chi. And then I was so shocked because there was a darkness. So she was following me, my recipes. Wherever I go, I meet my readers. So anyway, you pronounce my name Mang Chi so nicely that I know that you are good at cooking.
She did great. Yeah, that was wonderful. Well, I wanted to check out another recipe now. And you mentioned these in your lunchboxes, the tuna pancakes, yeah. And they look fantastic. You used canned tuna. Tell us about these pancakes.
Yeah, the reason I kind of introduced you to my tuna pancake is that for your audience who never learned any Korean cooking, you don't need any specific Korean ingredients. You have a can of tuna, then you can make it right now. So easy. Just a drain can of tuna, and then just mix with just one egg, and also, you know, a little bit chopped onion, green onion, and garlic. And we need some kind of a glue-like things, and the flour or rice flour, and mix it together, salt and pepper. And pan fry in the, like, so you are in a skillet, and just in 3 minutes, kind of a golden brown, and this is absolutely delicious. And because I added some chopped onion, it's kind of juicy. So, you know, just a few months ago, my daughter is an already grown-up adult, and she said, I asked her, what kind of side dish do you, like, still think about I used to make for you? She said, tuna pancake. In Korean champion, because she really liked it. And also, when I worked in Canada, I work for non-profit organization, and then mostly my coworkers are Koreans. And then I made a tuna pancake, and those guys, even Koreans, they love that. So they just, I just even like this, and I explained to them, they made right next day. So I just, for your audience, this is like, it's a Korean dish, but you guys can make it so easily at home.
We have that at WPR.org/Food Friday. We're talking to Mong Chi. Her new book is Mong Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking, From Everyday Meals to Celebration Cuisine. Back to your calls now. Melanie is with us in Wisconsin Rapids. Melanie, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. Mong Chi, komsamnida for your cookbook.
Oh, thank you very much. You said thank you very much in Korean. Awesome.
I did. I've been stationed overseas, and I spent a bit of time in Seoul here and there. And first of all, I have a crazy craving for kimchi all the time. I'm from German ancestry, so sauerkraut. So I love the fermented cabbage that all the different cultures have.
Mm-hmm.
I almost ate too much Korean barbecue when I was in Seoul because it's just so delicious with the leaves and everything that you wrap around, just to make your own little wrap. And then bibimbap, so the Korean food is just so delicious with all the varieties and the spice and everything. So I just love your food, and I wish people from central Wisconsin, where I'm from, had more of an opportunity to taste it because it really is so delicious.
It sounds like you are already a Korean food expert.
That's definitely, yeah. Thanks for that call, Melanie. Now, two people have mentioned the service, U.S. service in Korea. You actually have a recipe called, Mong Chi, Army Base Stew. Can you tell us about that?
Yes. Army Base Stew is that just, it looks like a junk food because we add kimchi plus all kind of, sausage inside and canned corn. And also even rice cake there, and everything inside, and just about, it turned out so delicious. That was not my favorite because of the ingredients, all kind of ingredients, kind of it doesn't look like go well together, but a lot of Koreans love that. So I made this, and these days I like it. Yeah, that's in Korean War, after Korean War 1950s, and then kind of in Korea, kimchi stew, kimchi soup is always existed, among Koreans. But around that time, the American soldiers, they just brought that all canned food, ham, sausage, these things. So it's going into Korean community.
Hmm.
And then somebody invented kind of, recipe. Okay, this kimchi stew, I can add this in sausage or ham. And then they make it so nicely. So that's why, that's called this, it's called that, American kind of, the station, that area. It's called Dongducheon. Dongducheon is a Gyeonggi province near Seoul. And that kind of food was just invented around there. So this is an army-based stew. It's an army, because there is an army base. So that's why still a lot of people love that army base stew.
Well, Mong Chi, thank you so much for joining us today. It's been a lot of fun.
Me too. Thank you.
That was Mong Chi. She was born and raised in South Korea. Her cooking video channel on YouTube has over 4 million followers. Her website is mongchi.com. That's MANGCHI.com. She talked to us today about her cookbook. It's called Mong Chi's Big Book of Korean Cooking. You can find the recipe for kimchi stew and more at WPR.org/Food Friday. Coming up Monday on Central Time, COVID-19 is changing a lot about our lives, including the English language. Grant Barrett and Martha Barnett from the public radio show Away with Words join us to talk about what's new in the way we speak. It may seem hard to find good stuff in a pandemic or a natural disaster, but it turns out that a lot of what we take for granted, especially in cities, are the result of innovations that come after a crisis. So we'll find out why. And most of us probably went to the grocery store on autopilot before COVID-19, but not anymore. We'll learn about the history of the grocery store and how it's shaped our lives and been shaped by us for decades. That's coming up Monday here on Central Time. There's a long-running joke about all the cat pictures people post on the internet. But they're not so bad compared to a lot of the other stuff on the internet. And we talked to a researcher a couple of years back who said that looking at goofy stuff online, like funny photos or videos of cats, can be actually good for our mental and emotional health. And that makes sense because it turns out that posting cat images is a long time honored tradition, in some cases with cats that are 120 feet long, drawn into a hillside. As reported in the Smithsonian Magazine, researchers in Peru have been finding images of a wide variety of animals dating from over 2,000 years ago, and their latest find is that 120-foot-long cat. How do you make an image that lasts 2,000 years? You make what researchers call a Nazca line, by removing rock and soil to leave a kind of negative image behind. And with a dry climate, those images stick around for a long time because vegetation doesn't fill in the gaps quickly. Long time, but not forever. There are concerns that erosion could wipe out parts of these line drawings. Scientists have been studying them on the ground, but now aerial photography and satellite imaging is making it a lot easier. Now back to that cat on the hillside. It's big. It sprawled out comfortably. It looks to me like a happy cat. So next time you share a cat photo on social media, be proud of it. You are part of a tradition spanning the ages. This is Central Time.